But someone finally has discovered a life well lived and worth knowing about. But it's been a long time in coming. Better late than never, I always say. So, in speaking to you today about the kinds of things that I do, I hope you get a sense of the kind of life I've had, the kinds of experiences that go to make up what happens to a writer. Now, what must I also say to you, that after all of these books, it's quite difficult sometimes. You know, you muse on something for 2 and 3 years, and you read for 2 and 3 years before you finally get a handle on it. You don't go and sit down under a tree and have a Newtonian experience, you know, or a Joyce Kilmer experience, or a Frost experience. I mean, those muses maybe are once in a lifetime, stopping by the woods on a snowy evening, you know, or trees. I mean, those once in a lifetime experiences. For the most part, most people go through their life very often knowing only that one poem by those poets. Just that one. Ask most people to recite 3 Robert Frost poems, and they can't. Or 3 Kilmer poems, they can't. But they all know Lovely as a Tree. So there's nothing else at all. And I do love always, Ross, to hear that my book inspired the work of the Cotton Club. I make that always clear, because I don't want anybody to ever confuse the book with the movie. See, I don't know how many people have seen the movie, but I can tell you right now there were no white guys playing and no band in the Cotton Club. Richard Gere got, I suppose, made a life of playing trumpet in the Cotton Club in the movie. It's inspired. It's not based. It's not based on, and it's not the book. I suppose you know, in a funny kind of way, I'm making a case for you people go out and buy the book, and not just rent the video. You see. But I see it already on my tombstone. Wrote the Cotton Club, and I tell people, no, please don't let that happen to me. Let me be known for something else. Let me be known for a body of work and the sharing of information and knowledge, mostly for the children, but for adults as well, because there's a lot of misinformation. There are a lot of things adults ought to read and don't. And I always tell my students, if you ever say to me, you read for entertainment, you're in trouble. Reading, it seems to me, is a requirement for all civilized, intelligent human beings, and is never for entertainment. You may be entertained, you may enjoy it, but it's civilizing, you see. It's liberating. So, it's good to see you here today. I'm glad to be in Key West today. Hopefully one day when I come to Key West, I can take off my necktie, since everybody seems as if they're so relaxed. Next time I come, I'm going to wear my polo shirt too. And I suppose I'll feel right at home with you, because this has been very nice, and I'll take any questions that you may wish to ask me. But thank you very much. Thank you. Yes.
A woman in the audience asked Mr. Haskins how and where he writes.
Talk. I sort of do it in cars and on airplanes. What I do is, you have to work sentences. I tell people, you didn't realize how many times it's hard work that I've written the word T-H-E. You have to really think about that. And the word A-N-D, I mean, that's as simple as I can get it. And it takes a while to work that sentence so that it is not one you've done before. And sometimes if you read five or six of my books, you may find the same sentences over and over and over again, because it's hard to do that. I try not to. I read a lot. I mean, I have people who help me do research, and sometimes they may even have to write my sentences over for me. So you see, because I think in a kind of stream of consciousness. And that's one of the things I had here to say to you, is that if you're doing a book, sometimes you read all of the research and all the material until almost the book is done in your head mentally, and then you set off to do it in a stream of consciousness. Sometimes the last chapter of a book comes out of your head before the first chapter comes out. That's what's good about editors. They sort of can keep you straight. So there's a process. And since I'm interested in all the same, since I'm interested in music and politics and revolution and religion, and once you do a basic research, for an example, my black music in America led to black dance. And black dance in America led to black theater in America, see. So people say, oh, well, that's a trilogy. Well, of course it is all the same thing. It's all the same thing, because they're interwoven, black music, black dance, black theater. So you have a genesis of basically three books. The difficulty is keeping dance in its place and music in its place and theater in its place, as it's very hard if you're dealing with Bubbling Brown Sugar, for an example, because it's dancing and music, so it's difficult. That's the best way I can explain it to you. You know, it's a complicated process, which is probably why we have conversations with ourselves. We speak kind of, yes.
A gentleman requests that Mr. Haskins address the problem of inner city schools.
The American school system, the problems with American school system dates back to the 1600s. I graduated from a school called Boston Latin in Boston, and that's the oldest public high school in America. And it's, you get there by a competitive examination. And at the history, so when that school started, it started for the children of the landed gentry, the Bremen, as it were, and they to keep out the riffraff, to keep out the children of the sailors, and to keep out the children of the merchant classes, who were not merchant class, you see. And once the people became aware of their having been had, then the city of Boston started another high school called Roxborough Memorial, and then Girls Latin. So that the history of American education, you see, is a history of an opportunity lost, because it's always been separate and unequal to some degree. There have been specialized schools. So these kids went here, and these kids went there, and these kids go there. Now, I tell people always that the American public school system is no place for exceptional children, and all people's children are exceptional. And somebody got wise to that and created parochial schools and then private schools when they realized what the public schools were doing. But I think that the real problem that you address here, that you are concerned with, is that you are concerned with Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, in that infamous decision of with all deliberate speed. Well, everybody knew, thought we were going to integrate the next year, but they forgot all deliberate speed meant you could go fast if you wanted to, you could go slow if you wanted to. So that at the point of integration of those school systems and the move to suburbia or exurbia or whatever it is these days, the mallification of America, I call it, at that particular event, schools became segregated again and unequal based on the property taxes, which are somehow we fund our school systems in this country, so that even suburban schools are much more well taken care of than the inner city schools because of property values. But the American public school system does exactly what it is supposed to do. Still, it is still discourages most American school children. It flunks them. It relegates them to low-paying jobs. It relegates them to a life of working and not thinking. Why we give them mortar boards, you know, when we graduate? Well, that's a workman's tool, you know, a mortar board. You go to work. And those of us who don't get mortar boards, we get what we call roundheads. We're roundheads, you see. Some of us are roundheads, and some of us are squareheads, and some of us are pointy heads. And you know, you see that very clearly in the processional at high school graduation or college graduation, the division of labor and work. So it is not easy to comment in any small manner on the question, because the question does not always necessarily imply race. It sometimes brings into task the whole idea of a class and economics. Even the class system has changed. It is no longer defined by money anymore, and it hasn't been since the 1960s with Nixon's, when Nixon became president, with his concept of benign neglect, which is Ed Banfield from Harvard's thesis. If you read that book, The Unheavenly City, you begin to see very clearly classes delineated in something else other than economic terms.
A member of the audience asked Mr. Haskins to comment on his choices for biographies, and if perhaps he had ever considered doing the biography of Louis Armstrong or James Baldwin.
Oh, James Baldwin? No. Louis Armstrong, I've done short bios of his life in black music in America. There have been two or three what I would call very good works on Louis's life, but unless someone gets the real, and I think Lucille is dead now, I'm not sure, Corporation of Lucille, and they're not going to be able to do much more than what has been done. James Baldwin, there are two biographies of Baldwin coming out, one by a professor down at Florida State University, and there, of course, is Quincy Troup's biography and a collection of essays about the life of Baldwin. With someone we were talking about that this morning in terms of having spent time here in Key West when Tennessee Williams was here, which is something I suppose it needs to be taken a look at, because I know he was quite fond of Key West. But Baldwin has not been done and ought to be done, and ought to be done well. It's one of those great literary biographies that someone needs to give me or somebody the $200,000 to do. Most publishers do not want to give you that kind of money unless you're matching grants from Guggenheim. And I'm sort of going to stay in the little corner that I've got for myself, and I'll leave the big $200,000 biographies to people like Levering Lewis, who have nothing, you know, these guys with endowed chairs, you know. But I'd love to be able to do something like that in semi-retirement. Don't tell anybody. The question is, comment on the black Muslim movement in America, and whether my thoughts on Louis Farrakhan, and what was the last part of that? No, I've done some work on Malcolm X. I have covered the Muslim movement in Black Power, my book on Black Power, but I've never considered doing a bio of a minister, Farrakhan. No, I've not. As far as commenting on the Muslim movement in America, I don't think that I have very much more to say that the New York Times has not said about it, that ABC has not said about it, Time Magazine. I just think that It's in America. And I think that anything that happens to us in America, whether we are white, black, blue, or brown, it happens to us, as in the words of Jimmy Baldwin, because we are at home. So if people don't like what is happening in that movement, then they ought to examine home. I'm much more concerned with terrorist acts in the World Trade Center than I am, I must say, than the Muslim movement. Since I fly a lot, I'm much more concerned about the North Koreans getting a bomb and Iranians having one. But then, of course, we'll leave it to the State Department, won't we? Or Anthony Lewis writing in the New York Times. You see, I have feelings and thoughts about a lot of things. I'm not so sure they're that important or that more significant to say than anybody else's point of view. I do know, and I do think, though, that they serve a very, very useful purpose. And I'm not so sure that I believe what I read in the press about what their motives and end goals are about. I mean, I've listened to the press tell me a lot of things over the years about quote-unquote black leaders and quote-unquote white leaders, for that matter, that I don't believe. I mean, just this morning, before I left here, Donahue had somebody on say the Holocaust didn't happen. I said, you know, well, I'm not even going to listen to that one. You know, but you hear it, but you say, hey, you know, this is not a debate I want to get into. Because if you see, 98% of most people are relatively uninformed and kind of stupid. And 2% of those who are intelligent or in serious. Serious the word I want of contamination by them. You're in a serious line of contamination. And so I don't listen to a lot of people. I don't listen to, there are just some writers I don't read anymore. I won't read them anymore. And there are certain columnists I won't read anymore. I mean, I never read Louis Grizzard. You know, Louis Grizzard, is that his name? You read him once. I mean, the guy who died, you read him once, you don't need to read him. Yes, I hand waved.
A man in the audience would like Mr. Haskins' views on black language, or the language that has grown up that is peculiar to and particular to the black experience and Afro-Americans.
Oh, you got time? Do you want the short answer or a long answer, or do you want the simplistic answer or the intellectual answer? The intellectual answer is that all cultural groups, without getting into any definitive definition of what constitutes culture, because language certainly is one that constitutes culture, and certainly the music and the food and the dress and all of that, and that all linguistical, all cultures have a certain linguistical pattern. Blacks in America's native language was never English, and the native religion was never Christianity. So that when you began to understand the slave experience and the slave ship and the journey of the passage to America, and 40 or 50 different African tribes all together on one boat, having to chained and having to have to communicate, speaking 40 different languages and sub-languages of Swahili and all sorts of other kinds of languages, that out of that language in the New World, mixed in with its English as it was spoken badly by the slave holder, the slave driver, certainly did not speak Bremen English, and certainly did not speak as well as the owner, the plantation owner. that was a language that was devised out of that, and that language came to be called black language. Now, even within those linguistical patterns, you had Gullah. For an example, the blacks in the Sea Islands off the coast of Georgia and South Carolina speak of a language called Gullah. Now, within Gullah, the Gullah construct, there is also Pidgin Gullah, or Pidgin of that dialect, what we call Africanisms in the American dialect. For an example, if I were Gullah today you and I walked out and looked up at the sky, and in standard English I would say, what color is the sky? You would say blue. Well, in Gullah, if I were going to ask that same question in Gullah, it would be high sky stan. You see, and then you'd look at me and say, what the hell is he talking about? Well, it's an alliteration of the Germanic part of the standard English context, since English is part Anglo-Saxon, part Latin, and part Greek. It is that Anglo-Saxon is part of the Gullah that makes it sound Germanic. How sky stand? Said fast together, it sounds German, but it really means how does the sky stand? And the answer, of course, for a Gullah child, a person would be blue. And so that's part of what happens. Now, dance and rap and tap came out of the same auction block, the same boat. It's no better or no worse than Morse code or SOS's. You watch Bojangles tap, and you watch Sammy Davis tap, and you watch the Berry Brothers tap, and some of those old dancers, Barney Coles. There's a message there in the tap. They're sending out messages. And that is how they're able to dance to the music, the step. Not unlike, I guess, not unlike Gene Kelly when he learned how to do it, or Shirley Temple when she learned how to do it. Sometimes people go through the motions of getting the steps and the markings on the stage, and other people just come by it naturally. Some people call then when you write down the steps if you're Balanchine choreography. Well, I don't know, you don't have to write it down for Bill Bojangles Robinson, you know, it's just. So, and then therein lies, and you see, the beginning of our understanding of what is better and what is worse, whether or not there's a written language or an oral history, and which is better. Written language, of course, always better for those who can read and write. You know, dancing is always nice if somebody can choreograph it for you. But it's not any better or that much worse than the other. I mean, there's Yiddish, and then there's Yiddish, there's German Yiddish, Polish Yiddish. You know, there's Yiddish theater, Yiddish newspapers. And then, you know, but the idea is to be able to make the transition from the forward to the New York Times, you know. And sometimes people can't, sometimes people don't. I'm told that there are whole cultures in America that refuse to even speak English. Well, explaining that, you would have to explain Chinatowns, Germantowns, Japantowns, Koreatowns, you know, Harlems. So it's not, that's part of the intellectual answer, part of the simplistic answer. And you get religious differences in there. And then you get ceremonies in there. Where things happen, how people devise a language. Rap is, as far as I'm concerned, political poetry is no different than Bob Dylan was doing and Peter, Paul, and Mary were doing in the 60s. It's the same thing, except that they're doing it in standard English, and the rap kids are doing in what they call urban ghetto, urban language, urban ghetto street language. In the 30s and 20s, have Calloway doing Heidi Heidi Oh, you call it a jive talk. I mean, but I think the whole emphasis on rap is getting a bad rap. This too will pass, like the twist. Yes.
The final question from a woman is, what does Mr. Haskin teach at Gainesville?
I'm an Americanist. And I teach adolescent and children's literature, and sometimes I teach a course for honors students only called Nobel Prize Winners, Pulitzer Prize Winners for a 10-year period. And sometimes I teach a course on variable topics, which is anything I want to. So I'm one of those itinerant full professors that they let basically do what he wants to. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a presentation by author Jim Haskins on the writing life. It was sponsored this evening by Friends of Library, the National Book Foundation, and the Florida Center for the Book. It all took place at the Key West Library and was recorded live by private ear. Another Key West experience that is much praised and has national attention is the Key West Literary Seminar. And that does take place in January, but the subject in the lineup is so outstanding, I'd like to tell you a little bit about who's coming. This year, the Key West Literary Seminar will be investigating journalism. And among the participants, all of whom have Pulitzer Prizes, are Phil Caputo, Maddie Blaze, Seymour Hersh, and Anna Quinlan, those who are well-known in their own right and very accomplished, but have not yet won the Pulitzer, are Barbara Ehrenreich and Brent Staples. If you want more information about the Key West Literary Seminar and how you can sign up or hear a little bit more, you can call them in Key West at 305-293-9291. I'm Meg O'Brien, and it's been a pleasure to have a program centered around our new area of listenership, Key West. Thank you and good night. And so, the conclusion of this evening's broadcast. Cover to Cover is a production of WLRN-FM. Tonight's broadcast was recorded by WLRN in cooperation with Books and Books. Post-production provided by Mario Lozada. The producer for Cover to Cover is Meg O'Brien. Please join us next week at 8 p.m. for another reading on Cover to Cover. For an audio cassette copy of tonight's program or any Cover to Cover broadcast, please call us in Dade at 995-2218 and outside of Dade at 1-800-273-6677. In Dade, 995-2218, and once again outside of Dade, 1-800-273-6677.